Lake Magog vaccine.
Your Lake Magog vaccine?
Yeah, you know, I'm really looking forward to having the whole family to the cottage for my annual cookout.
Smart move. I'm gonna ask for the Montreal vaccine. I miss those last-minute get-togethers with my buddies.
Nice. Well, I gotta run. I don't think it protects against lateness.
Each vaccination brings us closer to these moments. Follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID vaccine. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
By now, you've probably heard of Sheikh Jarrah and the struggle by the neighborhood's Palestinian residents to save their homes from being taken over by Israeli settlers. The fight to save Sheikh Jarrah has garnered international attention in recent weeks and has prompted widespread protests across Palestine and the entire world. But just a few kilometers away, another group of Palestinian families are facing an almost identical battle. 5 kilometers away from Sheikh Jarrah, right outside the Old City in occupied East Jerusalem, is the village of Silwan. Silwan lies at the heart of East Jerusalem and is home to an estimated 60 to 65,000 Palestinians. It's also one of the most heavily targeted areas in Jerusalem for Israeli settlement activity and what rights groups have called Israel's attempts to Judaize the city. Just south of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound is the Batn al-Hawa neighborhood of Silwan. For decades, Batn al-Hawa has been the target of a relentless campaign by settler organizations to forcibly expel Palestinian residents of the neighborhood and replace them with Jewish settlers, a process that is entirely legal under Israeli law. You're probably wondering, how is this even possible? In short, a right-wing settler organization by the name of Ataret Kohanim has been seeking to forcibly evict some 100 families from Batn al-Hawa under the pretext that the land was previously owned by Jews more than 100 years ago. Through a series of legal mechanisms sanctioned by the courts, Ataret Kohanim has been filing eviction orders against the families in Batn al-Hawa since 2002, with the goal of putting Jewish settlers in their place. And while Israeli law allows for property to be transferred to Jews who claim previous ownership from before the establishment of Israel, that same right is denied to Palestinians who were dispossessed from their homes during the Nakba in 1948. To date, Ataret Kohanim has taken control over 6 buildings in Batn al-Hawa, comprising 27 housing units, units that once belonged to Palestinian families. In the Batn al-Hawa neighborhood alone, Ataret Kohanim has ongoing legal proceedings to evict 81 families, numbering 436 people. Since 2015, 14 families in the neighborhood have already been forcibly evicted. And that's just in Batn al-Hawa. In several other neighborhoods within Silwan, other settler organizations are also seeking to evict more Palestinian families, while the Israeli government has placed demolition orders on dozens of Palestinian homes in order to make way for an archaeological tourist park and nature reserve. So, where does that bring us today? Well, in 2020, the Jerusalem Magistrate Court ordered the eviction of seven more Palestinian families in Batn al-Hawa. Two of those families were due to have their appeal cases heard on May 26th, but the Israeli court postponed its decision. Despite the postponement, the seven families, who number 108 people, are still under imminent threat of displacement. And they're not alone. According to a 2020 survey by the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, at least 218 Palestinian households in East Jerusalem, numbering 970 people and over 400 children, have eviction cases against them. Most of those cases were filed by settler organizations like Ataret Kohanim. Amnesty International and other human rights organizations have called on Israel to scrap the eviction plans in Silwan, saying that such forced evictions are, quote, flagrant violations of international humanitarian law that amount to war crimes. As their forcible displacement looms, Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan are asking the world to stand up against Israeli apartheid and are calling on people to continue bringing attention to their case on social media using the hashtags Save Sheikh Jarrah and Save Silwan.
So as you can see around us, the protesters are dispersing. People have gathered here on the mountaintop across from Jebel Sabiha, across from the Israeli outpost. They've gathered for Friday prayers. People haven't even gotten the chance to start praying yet. Friday prayers hadn't even started yet, and Israeli forces stationed on the mountain started firing tear gas from their tear gas guns and also from drones that they flew overhead and dropped tear gas canisters onto the protesters.
This has been the everyday reality for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank town of Beita for the past 8 weeks. In early May, a group of settlers arrived with caravans and occupied the top of Jebel Sabih, one of the tallest mountains in the Nablus district and a historic landmark in Beita. Since then, the protests in the village have been non-stop, and the Israeli response has been severe. Since protests began on Jebel Sabih, Israeli forces have killed 5 Palestinians, 4 residents of Beita, and 1 young man from the nearby village of Yatma. The latest victims of the Beita protests were 2 teenagers, 16-year-old Muhammad Hamayel and 17-year-old Ahmed Beni Shamsa. The 2 were reportedly school friends and were some of the hundreds of Beita's youth who participated in the protests regularly. Over the course of the past 2 months, hundreds of Palestinians from Beita and the surrounding villages have been injured by Israeli forces during the protests. A significant amount of those injuries have been from live ammunition. The highest recorded number of injuries in a single day was in late May, when local medics said that more than 70 people were injured with live ammunition in the span of just a few hours. While we were filming Friday protests in Beta, at least two young men were shot with live ammunition, one in the leg and one in the face.
We're here at the local field hospital in Beta. You can see that there's people around us waiting. We just got word that there's quite a critical injury that's happened on Jebel Sabiha. Someone was injured with live ammunition. So you can see here behind me that the first responders are waiting. They're waiting for the ambulance to get here so that they can treat the person who is injured. Again, this field hospital was set up by locals just in the past few weeks due to the sheer number of injuries that have happened in Beta, the sheer number of injuries of live ammunition. People have been injured with tear gas canisters, rubber bullets, and the locals here tell us that there have been more than 1,000 injuries with live ammunition just in the past month and a half because of protests on Jebel Sabiha.
The Eviatar outpost was erected by a group of Israeli settlers who, under the protection of the Israeli military, have successfully occupied the mountaintop and dozens of acres of land around it. Under Israeli law, outposts like Eviatar are considered illegal as they are built without prior approval from authorities, unlike formal settlements which are built and subsidized by the Israeli government. Despite this, the settlers in Eviatar have continued to grow the outpost, erecting an estimated 45 caravans and prefabricated homes in just a few weeks. The Israeli government has also provided the settlers on the outpost with paved roads, water lines, and electricity. Many of the settlers in Eviatar have come from surrounding settlements and outposts in the area, including the Yitzhar settlement, home to some of the most notoriously violent settlers in the entire West Bank. Just a few kilometers away from Beta is the town of Duma, where in 2015 a group of Israeli settlers set fire to a Palestinian home, killing three members of the Doabja family, including an 18-month-old baby. The Palestinians in Beta fear that if the outpost remains on their land, the settlers will become more violent, and their families could suffer a fate similar to that of the Doabjas. The most recent protests in Beta are the latest in a long history of anti-settlement resistance in the town. Since 1988, the people here have successfully fought off a number of attempts by Israeli settlers to take over their land. Just last year, Israeli settlers tried to occupy another mountain in the town, called Jabal al-Urma, sparking massive protests in the area. On March 11, 2020, hundreds of Beta's residents, including women, children, and the elderly, held a peaceful sit-in on the mountaintop. They were attacked by Israeli forces, who fired tear gas, rubber bullets, and live ammunition at the crowds. Abdul Ghani Dwekat was here that day with his 22-year-old son, Islam.
فضربني الرصاصتين هنا.
أنت تصوبت في نفس اللحظة.
لا زالت معي يعني موجودة أثرها. لا زال أثرها موجود.
Abdul Ghani joins a long list of parents in Beta whose children were killed by Israeli forces. Since 1967, 77 residents of the town have been killed by Israel, many of them during protests like the ones on Jabal al-Urma and Jabal Sabih. As the call to prayer rings through the town at sunset, the streets of Beta are practically empty. Most of the town's residents can be found making their way to Jabal Sabih for what they call the Night of Confusion.
يعني إشي إزعاج للمستوطنين في الليل.
طبعا هذا على أساس إنهم يزيلوا هاي البؤرة.
وهذا إشي بتصير كل ليلة عندكم؟
كل ليلة بصير. آه طبعا كل ليلة بصير.
Scattered across the mountain, the residents of Beta split into groups or teams, each one designated with a different task aimed at irritating and disturbing the settlers on the mountaintop. One team points lasers towards the outpost and Israeli troops stationed on the mountain, while other groups are tasked with blowing horns and making loud noises. And the rest, primarily young men, light torches and march down through the valley and set tires on fire to send smoke up towards the outpost. Miles from where the night confusions begin are other small groups of young men who get as close as they can to the outpost, where they face off against Israeli soldiers, armed only with rocks and homemade slingshots.
Right now, we're at one of the closest points to the settlement. It's about 400 meters away, and we're only around 200 meters away from where Israeli soldiers are stationed. You can see around me there are hundreds of young men who are lighting tires on fire, pointing lasers at the soldiers, making loud noises. This is all part of the night confusions. This is all part of the attempts from the young men, from the people in Beita, to continue protesting against the establishment of this outpost on their land. People here have come under fire from tear gas, from rubber bullets, from live ammunition. But they're still protesting. The noises, the reason they're screaming around us, this is part of their plan to annoy the settlers, to make the settlers leave, and to make them want to leave their outpost.
Hours into the night confusion activities, Israeli forces cracked down on protesters, using drones and military jeeps to fire tear gas, as well as rubber bullets and live ammunition.
The people here are fleeing the tear gas. You can see that there are hundreds of young men that started running from underneath. You can see they're covering their noses and their mouths. They were caught under dozens of rounds of tear gas from the Israeli soldiers, and now they're running away. They're retreating back up the mountain to get away from the tear gas.
Despite the violent response of Israeli forces to the protests, many families have continued to come to the mountain every single night for night confusion activities. Over the past, the protests in Beita have picked up steam and have drawn Palestinians from across the West Bank to join in solidarity. On this night, one group traveled from the city of Bethlehem to join in the night confusion activities, bringing their local youth drums team with them. In late June, after weeks of protests, the Israeli government, led by its new Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, reached an agreement with the settlers of Eviatar. The agreement stated that the settler families who were present at the outpost would leave the houses they built, but the structures themselves would stay and be converted into a yeshiva school. None of Beita's residents, nor the Palestinians who own land on Jabal Sabih, were consulted about the agreement.
أنا صراحة عصبت. أنا إحنا ولا إشي رح يرضينا إلا إن المستوطنة إن شاء الله ما بصير مستوطنة إنها ترجع زي ما كانت شجر زيتون. بس هذا اللي بيرضينا. شعورنا طبعا غضب عارم.
The people of Beita insist that whether it is in the form of a residential settlement or a school, the outpost is still illegal and must be removed from their land. Until that happens, they say they'll keep protesting, no matter the cost.
Welcome to This is Palestine. I am Omar Badar.
And I'm Deanna Boutu.
And today, we're looking at the growing tension between Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the Palestinian Authority. As protests spread in cities like Ramallah, Hebron, and Bethlehem, after Palestinian activist and dissident Nizar Banat was violently arrested by Palestinian security forces and then died in custody, leading to speculation that he was deliberately murdered by the Palestinian security forces. And as protests against the Palestinian Authority ignited,
So did the violence of the Palestinian security forces, who proceeded to attack protesters as well as confiscate phones and break cameras in an effort to suppress the images emerging of their violence from spreading. Deanna, I know that many of our listeners know what the PA is, but it might be worth explaining to those who may not fully get how a Palestinian semi-government functions under the ultimate authority of the Israeli occupation. Can you talk about what the PA is?
Sure. Thanks, Omar. The Palestinian Authority was a body, a governing body that was established in the early 1990s following the signing of the Oslo agreements. And what it did, what it is that the Palestinian Authority rules over very small parts of the West Bank and previously the Gaza Strip. Under the Oslo agreements, the West Bank was divided into three different zones: Area A, Area B, and Area C. Area A is the smallest of those areas, and it comprises roughly 18% of the West Bank, including all of the major Palestinian cities like Ramallah, like Bethlehem, like Al-Khalil, Hebron, like Tul Kerem, Jenin, and so on. And in those parts of Area A, it's not at all surprising that you see the highest concentration of Palestinians. Roughly 80% of the Palestinian population lives within Area A. Now, under the Oslo agreements, in Area A, this is where the Palestinian Authority can operate. But it's important to note that this isn't one contiguous area. It's divided into a number of small little islands that are disconnected and surrounded entirely by Area C, Area C being the largest part of the West Bank, more than 60% of the West Bank, and that is entirely under Israel's military control. So what the Palestinian Authority can do is very limited. They can provide hospitals in Area A. They can provide schools in Area A only. And they can do small municipal things like collect the garbage, pave the roads within these small areas. But that's about it. Now, the problem is that not only is there very little that they can do, there's then a huge expectation that they're supposed to maintain control and security control over these areas. And under, again, under the Oslo agreement, Area A is the only area where the Palestinian Authority has security control, which is to say that Palestinian security forces, including the police, including the paramilitary, operate within these areas. But beyond those areas, the Palestinian Authority simply cannot operate. And for example, to be able to get from one part of Area A to another part of Area A, these Palestinian security forces need Israeli permission. So in effect, all that they are doing is they're a small government that doesn't have the ability to really control anything. For example, they don't have their own currency. They don't have the ability to control fiscal policy. There's no control over the airspace. There's no control over Palestinian waters. There's no control over any of the borders. So in effect, it's the equivalent of having a small municipal or city government within a larger state.
Just to reiterate what you're describing, all of the West Bank is under Israeli military occupation, and an illegal occupation, by the way. But within the Israeli-occupied West Bank, there are small bits that are known as Area A, where the overwhelming majority of Palestinians are concentrated, and those are the areas where the Israeli occupation passed on security responsibilities for directly policing Palestinians to the Palestinian Authority.
Correct. That's exactly correct.
So by no means can anyone think of the PA as a government, because they function exclusively within the confines of what the Israeli occupation allows them to do.
Well, it's even beyond that. Not only can we not think of them as a government, the Oslo agreements specifically say that this isn't a state and shouldn't be thought of in any way as a government. And it spells it out very clearly. So, for example, under the Oslo agreements, the Palestinian Authority isn't to have a foreign minister. Under the Oslo agreements, the Palestinian Authority cannot even arrest an Israeli. So, for example, if an Israeli comes into Area A, commits a crime, including murder, the Palestinian Authority has no ability to even arrest that Israeli. All that they can do is simply hand over the person to the Israelis, and that's it. And so you're really functionally talking about an area where all that the Palestinian Authority can do is control its own people. And this is precisely what the Israelis wanted. They got tired of being in security control over the lives of people, but they certainly wanted to continue to control land and territory and water and resources. And so they handed over the control of people, 80% of them, to the Palestinian Authority to serve effectively as the police force for the Israeli military occupation.
So let's talk about the incident that triggered the latest protests. I'll admit that I did not know much about Nizar Banat until news of his death in PA custody emerged. Who was he?
Nizar Banat was a Palestinian activist who was based in Khalil, in Hebron, and who had a very large Facebook following, something to the tune of about over 100,000 people who were following him. And it's not at all uncommon for dissidents of the Palestinian Authority to have large followings. In fact, this is often the way that people are able to assess just how popular or how unpopular the Palestinian Authority is. He wasn't just a dissident. He would often write about what was going on with the Palestinian Authority. He often wrote about, as he put it, the Dayton forces. He used to call the Palestinian Authority the Dayton forces because they had received so much money from the Americans, in particular General Dayton. And so he wrote often on Facebook about his critique of the Palestinian Authority. He also was going to run in the parliamentary elections that were supposed to take place on May the 22nd, but were canceled. He was number two under a party that was called the Freedom and Dignity Party. And when those elections were canceled, he had gone to and initiated a case, said he was going to initiate a case before the European Court of Human Rights, demanding that these elections take place or demanding that the Europeans stop providing funding to the Palestinian Authority. So in short, he was somebody who was vocal about his critique of the PA. He had a significant following, and he wasn't afraid to come out and say that the Palestinian Authority was operating on Israel's behalf. He wasn't afraid to say that they were working on behalf of the United States, and he definitely wanted to see a better future for Palestinians.
And to call his death suspicious is a bit of an understatement. I mean, we have a reasonably good idea of what happened here, given how violent his arrest was, right?
Yes, we've seen video as he's being taken out from his home at 3 o'clock in the morning. We see video of him being hit as he's being taken out at 3 o'clock in the morning, and he ends up dying a few hours later after receiving blows to the head. It's not at all suspicious. It's clear that he was killed. He didn't just magically die.
I suppose the reasonable range of possibility goes from he was deliberately murdered to, at the very least, he was accidentally killed while he was being brutalized. So, in no plausible scenario are the security forces' hands clean here. And while the killing was the spark of these protests, there is a lot of underlying frustration with the PA that has been building for many years, right?
Oh, definitely. And not only is there a longstanding frustration, there's longstanding repression of any dissent against the Palestinian Authority. Look, for years and years and years, we've seen the dissent expressed in media, and then Mahmoud Abbas turns around and shuts down that media. We've seen dissent expressed on the streets, and again, protests get shut down on those streets. We've seen dissent expressed through people leaving Fatah and joining other political parties. And we also see the response by the Palestinian Authority, where these people are labeled traitors and so on. And so there's been a lot of frustration with the Palestinian Authority. The last public opinion poll before Israel's attack on Gaza was showing that Mahmoud Abbas was not going to win the upcoming elections, that Fatah was not going to win the upcoming elections. And this was probably the reason that these elections ended up being canceled, that he canceled the elections. And even before that, we've seen numbers as high as 66% of Palestinians saying that Mahmoud Abbas should resign. And this has been a long-standing, long-growing line of dissent. And alongside that growing dissent, there has been constant repression on the part of the Palestinian Authority, including now. For example, just today, we learned of the dismissal of Ihab Seeso from the National Archives. Now, Ihab Seeso was the former Minister of Culture, somebody who was often seen praising Mahmoud Abbas, who served in the government under Rami Hamdullah, the most recent government under Rami Hamdullah. And after the Hamdullah government fell, he was given the post of taking over the National Archives. And just today, after he posted a post on Facebook critical of and actually condemning the killing of Nizar Banat, he was also magically dismissed. This is the way that the Palestinian Authority operates, Omar. If you do anything or say anything against them, they find ways to crack down and exact their revenge.
So there's nothing surprising about the repression that we're witnessing. But what about the broader Palestinian political scene? How are other parties and actors responding to this moment?
It's causing some waves, to put it mildly. You know, to speak about the repression is important. And we've seen over the years the tactics that this government, and in particular Mahmoud Abbas, has used against people who are dissidents. So, for example, the beatings that we've seen Palestinian journalists, all of whom are female, the ones who've received beatings, that's not at all unusual. Yeah, I can give you just a personal story, Omar. A few years ago, when I wrote an opinion piece calling for the Palestinian Authority to be dismantled, because it should be dismantled, the person who is privileged, ended up receiving death threats on a daily basis. I became persona non grata. My car was vandalized. It got to the point where people were warning me that I shouldn't be living in the West Bank any longer. And that was me, somebody who is privileged. You can imagine what they do to people who don't have that level of privilege. You can just imagine.
Yeah, who aren't on CNN or have Canadian citizenship.
Who don't have a foreign passport. Exactly. That was exactly it. So I have a foreign passport. And so you can just imagine what happens to other people. And similarly, when all of this was happening, one of the lines that they used against me, which is the same line that they use against all of the people who are protesting, is that we were carrying foreign agendas, so to speak. That was exactly the word that they use, agendat ajnabi, foreign agendas. In my case, they also claimed that I was carrying an Israeli agenda because I happen to have a citizenship because I'm a Palestinian with Israeli citizenship. And that's what they do, is they smear you. And so the reaction from other political parties has been interesting, because we've already seen that the People's Party has pulled out of the government. There is talk of other political parties also pulling out of the government. But that's not enough. There needs to be more action to show this government that they can't continue with complete impunity. You know, Omar, Mahmoud Abbas now, if you look at what it is that he controls everything in the West Bank. And this isn't an exaggeration. He controls the courts and the judicial system. He controls the security and all of the security apparatuses. He has cracked down on the media. He has cracked down on NGOs that are opposed. He's even cracked down on, as you've seen, private individuals who come out and speak against what's happening. And so this is not at all something that should be tolerated. And this is why you see that there are calls now by individuals saying that the Europeans should cut off their funding to the Palestinian Authority, with the Europeans responding saying that their funds don't go to these security forces, but instead they go to what's called the blue police, the regular police. But it's all effectively the same and the same system.
You mentioned that you were personally smeared as working on behalf of an Israeli agenda, which is unimaginably ridiculous given that you were protesting collaboration with Israel's agenda. But there are many who once called for the dismantling of the PA. And now Mahmoud Abbas is old and his health isn't great, and he's not really grooming anyone to replace him. I know that speculating about the future is hard, but can you talk about the possibilities of what comes next?
Omar, this is the problem. We just don't know. You know, it's interesting. Back in 2002, 2003, and early 2004, this was a question that I was asked very often. What's going to happen when Arafat dies? And at the time, I remember scoffing and responding and saying, we know what's going to happen. There's going to, the Speaker of the House will take over for this prescribed period, and then we're going to have elections, and we're going to choose a new president. That's what's going to happen. And people were saying, no, there's no way that it's going to be so peaceful. And with Mahmoud Abbas, the problem is we just don't even know what the system is this time around. And the reason we don't know is we don't have a legislative council. He dismissed the legislative council a long time ago and announced that the Speaker of the Legislative Council, the Speaker of the House, is no longer Speaker of the House. So it's not going to go to that individual. And we've never seen any form of elections, including primaries or including within Fatah itself. And so, again, it's not clear what's going to happen on that level either. So this is the major problem, is that he hasn't even set up a system to be able to pass the baton, because he's created a system in which he wants everyone to believe that he is the only person who can be in control. He's the only one who can be in charge. And that's why this part is so terrifying for many people, is that we just don't know what's going to happen.
There is indeed a lot of uncertainty about where we go from here, but one thing is certain, and it's that the Israeli occupation is not the only layer of oppression that Palestinians live under, and that the struggle for justice entails confronting all systems of oppression. Diana, thank you so much for having this conversation. It was very enlightening.
Thank you, Omar. Thank you for listening to This is Palestine, a podcast brought to you by the Institute for Middle East Understanding. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to NewsClick. Today we're very happy to be joined from Jerusalem, Palestine, by Fairuz Sharkawi, who is the Global Mobilization Coordinator for Grassroots Al-Quds. Fairuz, welcome to NewsClick.
Thank you, Vijay. I'm very happy to be here.
It's great to have you. I wanted to start by asking you about something that you've become quite famous for. You quite famously say of people who come and visit Palestine that they seem to have all the solutions for the Palestinian people, but nobody seems to listen to what the Palestinians are saying and what the Palestinians want. What do the Palestinians want
Well, that is certainly what I think is going on. And I think that the Palestinians want to lead the change they want to see in Palestine. I think that Palestinians on many different levels, working in different fields, are finally reaching a conclusion. And this is the result of a process of trial and error and experience and trying and seeing for ourselves many experiences that disappointed Palestinians, experiences and people and voices that came and suggested solutions, and these solutions did not work. They did not become real. They did not hold. They were not sustainable. And so I think that what is mostly going on today in Palestine is that Palestinians are aware that if we want to reach freedom and liberty and achieve self-determination, then we need to dictate the rules of the game. We need to decide which path to take, and we need to lead our movement and struggle.
You know, it's very, what you're saying is very true. When you say a word like we need to lead, I think it's hard to disagree with you. The problem, of course, is who is the we? There are so many different factions in Palestine. There is the Palestinian Authority, and so on. I remember now over a decade ago when the Palestinian political prisoners wrote a letter from their jails. One of the things that they mentioned in the letter, Fairuz, and I think this is a point that I think is often forgotten, is that they asked for the different political groups to come together and construct a new Palestinian project. Who is the we that you're talking about?
Well, I am certainly not talking about political parties, and I am not talking about the Palestinian Authority as our political leadership. When I say we, I mean the people. I mean the grassroots. Our political leadership is one of the obstacles on our path to freedom and to liberation. The Palestinian Authority is certainly not the we I am talking about. The Palestinian Authority, as I see it, as many Palestinians see it, is just an integral part of the colonial system in Palestine. And it is not only allowing, but enabling and serving the occupation and the Israeli colonial project in Palestine. And so when I say we, I am talking about the people. I am talking about civil society organizations. I am talking about grassroots movements that are happening and have formed over many years in Palestine. So I'm talking about people that are creating this change on the ground. I'm talking about a network of organizations and movements and individuals and businesses and many, many, many institutions, not formal in that sense, that are working today. They are, many of them are working locally because of the political reality that is based on the divide and conquer and the fragmentation. So the fragmentation of the Palestinian communities, of Palestinian territories, of Palestinian cities, and also within the same district between the different villages and the city. And so a lot of work is being done. It is inspiring. It is amazing. People are realizing the power that they have. So you see, for example, farms that are being built or created or taking new paths into how do we market our products, how do we market our produce in a way that is, it helps us sustain ourselves because eventually we are fighting a big, well-oiled economic system that is the occupation's economy, and these farms are now working locally into sustaining themselves. And when I say we, I am talking about all of these dots connected into one big network of coordinated popular movements that push the Palestinian struggle into that direction that is also dictated by the people themselves.
No, that's a very hopeful sign if indeed there are these dots that are connected into a network. Of course, at some point, the political parties will have to become part of this because they also have sections of the people with them. I mean, I suppose I'm going to ask you a question that comes from a slight sense of disbelief in a way, because at this time, you're dealing with Israel back to the hilt by the U.S. government, by the whole of the U.S. government, Democrat and Republican Party, seems to raise issues with the Europeans, but they don't seem to have a problem with his agenda, if you come down to it. Given all this, it's with disbelief that I ask you, how can a group of farmers stand up to this extraordinary power block?
Listen, being hopeful is part, I think, of being a Palestinian or any person who lives under oppression. It's a part that if you lose, then it's sad and it's not a good sign about the future. But at the same time, of course, there is the awareness of how the situation, how hard the situation and challenging the situation is. Of course, yes, we are talking about a colonized people who have no sovereignty, no authority, that are under attack on so many different fronts. The occupation and the Israeli colonial policies and plans on the one hand, and then our own political leadership, the Palestinian Authority, who is also oppressing the Palestinians regardless of the occupation. I mean, any criticism of the Palestinian Authority takes you to jail, which is something we are witnessing right now. So many different fronts, and also international economic colonization of Palestine as well. And so it is very challenging without any organizing. And I am not saying that the Palestinian people are close to being ready for this confrontation. But it's very important to be strategic. It is very important to, first of all, understand what you are facing. And I think that it is clear now for Palestinians that we are facing a very well-oiled Israeli Zionist occupation machine, but that is also enabled and allowed and enabled by an international complicity, by governments and corporations, and with a lot of help from within. And of course, when I say international, I am talking about also about the Arab world, in just a hint towards current news about the United Arab Emirates. And so it's important to be aware what we are facing. It is important to learn from our mistakes, but also from our strong experiences. At the same time that I say that we have tried international aid, for example. International aid came with a big promises and big hopes for the Palestinian people. And in the beginning, we were very happy because someone is actually trying to help. Someone is pouring money into Palestine. And then it took us a decade or two to understand very quickly that this system is corruptive. This system is part of the colonial system globally. It is an extension of colonialism and not an answer to it. And so after experiencing all of these negative experiences and learning from them, we also should remember our history, and we should remember the not so far away past during the First Intifada, for example, how many inspiring examples we had of community organizing, proper community organizing, and it was the people leading the movement. Back then, the political parties and the factions were part of the people. Today, they are no longer part of the people, and that is why there is this alienation, and that is why there is no cooperation between them. We have different discourses, we speak a different language. They don't represent the people as they used to in the past. But in the not so far away past, they were an integral part of the people, and we had a very beautiful example of how our resistance can look. And so learning from these experiences in the past, we have the tools to build our future. And so it's hard. I am not saying that it's going to be easy. I am saying that with each year, and then 5 years and a decade passing, with all of the pain and the disappointment and the frustration, we should also see the hope. We should also see the knowledge, the ability to plan for our future, and most of all, realizing that it should be us leading, otherwise it will not work.
I think that, you know, it's not just that there's been a corrosiveness in the politics inside West Asia. I mean, it's not just in the West Bank or in East Jerusalem. It's, of course, the whole region is convulsed, has been convulsed by war since, let's say, the U.S. invasion of Iraq and around that period. But now even more, and I want you to reflect on this, even more stalwart allies of the Palestinian people, like the Indian government, for instance, stalwart ally. You know, Yasser Arafat used to say, Indira Gandhi is my real sister. You know, when I remember in 1983, when Arafat came for the non-aligned meeting, he was greeted at the tarmac in Delhi airport by Indira Gandhi. He was not a head of government, you know, and she came to meet him because they had a real bond. And now the real bond is Narendra Modi with Benjamin Netanyahu. The attrition of international interstate support for Palestine has been quite extraordinary. And the United Arab Emirates coming out in this way is not new in that sense. How are Palestinians seeing this loss of support, you know, from countries like India buying arms from Israel, the UAE and so on? How are Palestinians seeing this loss of support?
Well, on the one hand, Palestinians are not surprised. Maybe less surprised from the Emirates than India, I'm not sure. But it's not like the Palestinians are not aware that there are secret relations that are built by Israel with not only Arab countries, but many, many countries around the world. And people are angry, of course. But I think people are also a bit tired of the drama, maybe. It's not a huge change in reality. It's not a huge change in facts on the ground. And there is a Palestinian voice that says, okay, at least we appreciate the honesty. We appreciate that it's official. It makes it easier for us to face it. But in general, I think that's a very important point to make about Israel situating itself in a very central place globally when it comes to economy, when it comes to high tech, when it comes to development, when it comes to arms trade. And that is one of the strengths that Israel has that, unfortunately, even us Palestinians, we tend to forget when we talk about international support to Israel. People usually, immediately, it's easier to remember the $3.8 billion that are sent every year by the United States. Maybe people remember Germany selling submarines to Israel, but people do not remember that Israel is developing Africa. The fact that Israel is interfering in conflicts around the world, benefiting as a warlord from selling arms, from selling techniques and technology for population control, for incarceration, for prisons, military, all of the expertise that Israel has here, it is selling globally. And I think that it is important that we become aware of it, first of all, which also makes us aware of the global also change in the atmosphere globally. The world is becoming more far right. The world is becoming fascist, openly fascist and Nazi. And it's becoming more and more frustrating every day to see another government fall and another government fall, imperialism, capitalism. And this is the result of that, that the result of capitalism taking over the world is that it has become law. It has become something that is very easy to ditch. It's very hard to break free out of. And that is the result when Israel is building capitalist relationships with these countries, then these countries' foreign policy is always going to support Israel. They vote to support it in the United Nations votings. They give it money, they give it products. And so we are facing this big network and that's, for example, a point where at the organization I work at Grassroots Al-Quds, in the past 5 years ago, we decided that our international advocacy should not go towards decision makers. Decision makers are not going to care about the report that I have so carefully written, citing international law and the Fourth Geneva Convention and speaking about human rights violations in Palestine. It might move them personally, but as a person doing this job in some other countries' government, they're not going to go by human rights. They go by economic interest. And so we decided that we are shifting our advocacy towards the grassroots, towards the people in these countries. And we count on the people in other countries becoming aware of their own political realities, becoming aware that the same government that is supporting Israel is the same government that is probably oppressing you, that is probably building a harsher political reality to you internally. These are two sides of the same coin. As long as there is oppression of people of color in the United States, and this means, and in indigenous Americans, of course, this means that the foreign policy is also going to be supportive of Israel in Palestine. It might be supportive of other colonizers and other countries and governments that are oppressing others anywhere else. It's a network. It's a network of oppressors, and we should build our global network of resistance against it.
You know, I don't know if you know, Fairuz, but in 2017, the All India Kisan Sabha, which is the farmers movement in India, the communist farmers movement, it's the mass organization of the Communist Party of India, Marxist, the All India Kisan Sabha, 16 million members, Fairuz, voted for boycott, divest and sanctions with Israel. Now, the reason I'm raising this to you is I'm sure you didn't know that.
No.
Because one of the things I find is that even BDS is directed to Europe and the United States and not to South America, Africa, and Asia. And I wonder if there is room to reflect a little bit on the need, as you say, to pivot from so-called decision makers to the people. Is there a way for Palestinian solidarity to return once again from an obsession with what the United States is thinking to what's going on in the other countries of the South?
Yeah, certainly. That's a very good point. First of all, I am sorry, I don't know enough to speak about the history, but I think it should be researched, and people should find out what happened with Palestine and other countries' solidarities that existed in the past. I think back then we had the PLO as a serious representative of the Palestinian people, and they took very good care of building and maintaining these networks. And now the current leadership is certainly not doing a good job, not even trying to do a good job, because that is not the job that was given to them. But at the same time, I think what made it easier to connect with Europe and the United States is the fact that they are the white world that has the means to come to Palestine and to start building these connections. And then they invite Palestinian speakers to their countries. They can afford it. And so that was easy to start there. But I certainly think that what is even more important to build around the world is solidarity networks between the people that are the global South, that are the people that are facing the oppressive systems and regimes. And I think that, first of all, we have a lot more in common. And when I speak, I imagine that when I speak to an audience in India, they would know and understand and be able to imagine what I am describing much better and much more easily than a white old lady sitting in Pittsburgh. And so I think that it is very important to build these relationships first, because we have a lot in common, which is going to be a very important factor in building that solidarity. But also, I think that we are the people that should shift this global power structure. And so it's important that we support each other's movements, we support each other in our struggles. I think that no struggle can succeed locally because, again, we are facing a global machine. And so I think that these struggles should be connected. They should support each other's work. They should push each other forward. And at the same time, also build long-term strategies and visions to a better new world.
Fairuz Sharkawi of Grassroots Al-Quds, thank you so much for joining us at NewsClick.
Thank you very much for having me.
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
It takes a good dose of courage and perseverance to get through a pandemic.
True, but it also takes a good dose of patience, resilience, confidence, optimism, humor, and love. Not to mention a dose of determination, endurance, empathy, motivation, hope, and ingenuity.
But above all, it takes a second dose of vaccine.
A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Following is a previously broadcast program.
Aller avec toute la famille?
Pas bête, ça. Moi, je vais demander mon vaccin restaurant. Ça me manque les soirées improvisées avec les amis.
Hey, moi, j'y vais. Je pense pas qu'il fonctionne contre les retards, ce vaccin-là.
La vaccination nous rapproche de tous ces moments. Suivez la séquence de vaccination prévue dans votre région et prenez rendez-vous à québec.ca/vaccin-COVID. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
About it, save your-